It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk about a project that's using 25 trail cameras to monitor wildlife on the largest of the Apostle Islands. First, 128 countries condemned the United States' position on Jerusalem yesterday. The UN General Assembly passed a resolution demanding that the U.S. rescind its decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. The decision was criticized throughout the Middle East and Europe when President Trump announced it earlier this month. Now it's received a symbolic but formal rejection from a majority of the international community. Dali Afemi is an associate professor of political science at Long Island University in Brooklyn. She joins us now to tell us what the latest move from the UN means for the United States and its role on the world stage and the decades-old conflict around Jerusalem. Dali, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me on.
Well, can you talk about the significance of this resolution from the General Assembly?
So it's interesting. It comes on the heels of what happened on Tuesday, which was when the United States vetoed a proposition that was put on the table by Egypt, preventing any nations to build their missions or move their missions or build any more missions in Jerusalem. And that was, of course, vetoed by the United States after a strong statement from the ambassador. And so here we had 2 days later a resolution that was called in a kind of emergency session of the General Assembly to condemn the United States, basically, to say that this is null and void. And so it's really one of the more interesting things that we've seen in the U.S. history in its relations with the United Nations, that there is an actual session called an emergency to condemn the United States, basically. We usually see these emergency sessions of condemnation for, you know, countries who are abusing citizens or possibly committing a genocide. And so, you know, because this has the potential to derail a lot of work, we actually saw the calling of a special session.
And Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, had some strong words for the countries that called on the U.S. to rescind the Jerusalem policy and kind of a warning before this vote. Here's a listen.
The United States will remember this day in which it was singled out for attack in the General Assembly for the very act of exercising our right as a sovereign nation. We will remember it when we are called upon to once again make the world's largest contribution to the United Nations. And we will remember it when so many countries come calling on us, as they so often do, to pay even more and to use our influence for their benefit.
What kind of reaction, Dalia, was there to that threat, in effect?
So it's pretty interesting that both the ambassador and the president said that what we're doing here is exercising the will of our population, basically of Americans. But what we know through several polls, the latest which was released this morning by CNN, is that, in fact, 49% of Americans say the U.S. Embassy in Israel should not be moved from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And only 36% of Americans support this move. So it's not clear that this is in the interest of the U.S. population that's pushing for it, as is being depicted. But if we look at the language and the manner and the tone with which basically member states are being bullied and told, if you do not do this, we will punish you in the future. We will remember. The United Nations was founded on building consensus on international issues, not for member states to actually threaten one another into certain behaviors. And what we're seeing is, you know, this is not the first incidence of this. You know, with the withdrawal of the United States, for example, from the Paris Agreement a few months back, you saw the international community look at the United States, scratch their head, and say, "Okay, you guys are out. We're going to go ahead and do this without you." And yesterday was another symbol of, okay, you think you can bully your way, but maybe you can't. We're going to go ahead and do this anyway. And so I think what's more telling is that if you take a larger step back, the vote was not a surprise in that most resolutions on Palestine and Israel come out in the same way, with maybe one or two or up to nine voting just as they did yesterday, with the same number of abstentions, give or take five. But because of the nature of the threatening language, this became international news, where it probably would not have been otherwise. You know, for example, the 2012 recognition of Palestine, same, very similar vote. Nine voted against, 41 abstained. So with this language of we will remember and we will punish you, emboldens countries to say, no, we are actually going to stand up for our own citizens. We will not be told what to do. And so the question becomes, what will be the United States' role on the international world stage, and what will it be its role with relation to the United Nations? I mean, we remember in 1991 when the United States, actually the Coalition of the Willing, went into Iraq to, you know, liberate Kuwait and to get Saddam Hussein back into his own territory. This was seen as a celebration of victory. In the United States, it was our last, for example, it was our last victory parade held in New York City for our military. But this was really seen as victory of a coalition led not just by the United States, but agreed on with a UN mandate. We saw very quickly thereafter U.S. missions with the United Nations in Somalia, and then in Bosnia, and then in Kosovo. And it led to the kind of growth of not unilateral, but multilateral cooperation on international issues. What we've seen more recently is a regression on this. And the kind of risk that we're taking with this kind of language is that our traditional allies, but really the international community, is not going to give a lot of weight to this thing called multilateral action in the name of international relations and international security.
We're talking to Dalia Femi from Long Island University, looking at the UN vote rebuking the U.S. recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Can you talk about the significance of Jerusalem here? I know this is a huge topic, but in a nutshell, why is this so controversial for so many?
Well, Jerusalem itself is controversial because of the nature of its history. Between 1948 and, of course, the 1967 wars, it was West Jerusalem after 1948 Arab-Israeli war that was captured, and we saw East Jerusalem later on in 67. However, the jurisdiction and the ownership of Jerusalem has never been recognized by the international community, including the United States, as being a city wholly belonging to Israel. It's actually seen as a city that should come under international sovereignty and international control because of the Abrahamic nature of the three major faiths being represented in this small territory, in this small space. And so the 1947, for example, UN partition plan was to divide the city between the Arab and the Jewish states, and Jerusalem would have been granted special status. And so what we're seeing is that the division of the city into East and West Jerusalem, where East Jerusalem still is not under the legal jurisdiction of Israel, and for this to be seen as the capital of the state of Israel is very controversial. On the contrary, according to the OIC, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, 56 member states, who also issued a statement yesterday, that it would be East Jerusalem that becomes the capital of Palestine. And so what we're seeing here is language that goes against the legal doctrine, what's internationally recognized, and the sovereignty of that territory. Jerusalem is not a unified city and is not legally under the control or legal possession of the state of Israel, even though today it is under control of Israel because of the occupation of East Jerusalem. And so this is, you know, this is not just language, but this is a move that not just renders the United States not a neutral partner in the resolution of this conflict in the long term, but questions what the legal status of the city is going to be, because the final status agreements on what is going to be a one-state or two-state solution is tied to the future of the city of Jerusalem. And so it's not clear, for example, if this city and its the contest over it today is indicating that the possibility of a peaceful solution or a peaceful resolution or a settlement on the Arab-Israeli conflict is going to be seen in the short term.
We'll leave it there for now. Dalia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Dalia Femi, Associate Professor of Political Science at Long Island University in Brooklyn and Senior Fellow at the Center for Global Policy in Washington, D.C. She joined us to look at the UN General Assembly's rebuke of President Trump's decision that recognizes Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Right now, 25 trail cameras have been placed on Madeline Island, the largest of the Apostle Islands located along Lake Superior at the northern edge of Wisconsin. The cameras are part of the Wild Madeline Project conducted by 10 students and their professor at Northland College. Their goal is to expand wildlife data for the island. Eric Olson is the Wild Madeline Project leader and assistant professor of natural resources at Northland College. Eric, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks a lot, Rob.
Well, among the Apostle Islands, Madeline Island seems unique in a lot of ways. For one, I know I've driven there. I don't think I could do that on any of the other apostles. What do the differences of Madeline Island from all the others mean for wildlife there?
In addition to being a great place to recreate and visit, as you mentioned, you have, and also a culturally important place for the Ojibwe tribes of this region, it's a great place for wildlife research as well because of some of the differences that Madeline Island has between it and the other islands. First of all, Madeline's the largest of all the Apostle Islands within the archipelago, and it is one of the only islands that is not a part of the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore, and it also has a fairly high abundance of roads, and there's a lot of human traffic on the island as well from both tourism as well as there's a year-round residents that live out there. And so those differences allow us to look at how wildlife might be impacted by some of the island characteristics in terms of both size and distance from mainland, but then also how human development and road networks might also influence the wildlife ecology of these island systems.
And you're using trail cameras to get a grip on what is there, who's there when it comes to wildlife. Can you talk about how you're using these cameras to survey the wildlife of Madeline Island?
Yeah, sure. So we're using a large network of trail cameras, or also known as camera traps. And these are the same kind of cameras that many folks, some of your listeners probably use these to monitor wildlife on their own properties. And these cameras, we're using them to compile some of the first detailed information regarding the wildlife of Madeline Island. To do that, we have established a network of 25 camera stations along a 1-by-1-kilometer grid throughout Madeline Island Wilderness Preserve and the Big Bay State Park, two areas where we've got permission to be able to install and maintain camera traps. And again, as I mentioned earlier, Madeline Island is unique amongst the other islands because it does have a fair amount of private land. And so these are two of the areas, the Madeline Island Wilderness Preserve and Big Bay State Park, where we can actually, we can put trail cameras out without being on those private lands. And so we put these trail cameras out, students, undergraduate students, navigate to these locations in our camera trap network using GPS units, and then they place the cameras in areas that are likely to capture wildlife locally. So if the point ends up being in a thicket of dense shrubby vegetation, that's not the most effective place for camera placement. So they'll move it to a little bit more of an open area where the camera can best function. And in placing cameras, we also try to avoid areas of high human use. Our goal here is not to necessarily capture humans on a regular basis, so we avoid those areas. And then depending on whether or not our protocol calls for it, some of these cameras also get a scent lure that the scent lure helps us detect some of the more elusive species that might not necessarily, even if they were locally present, want to wander in front of our trail cameras. So these scent lures help us capture more of the carnivore species. And so then those camera traps are maintained out on the landscape, and we revisit them every once in a while to replace memory cards and batteries. And then we bring the data back into the lab where we store it, and we begin entering it into a database that allows us to ask a whole host of questions.
We're talking to Eric Olson from Northland College, talking about the Wild Madeline Project, tracking wildlife on Madeline Island. And Eric, who have you spotted in some of these pictures?
Yeah, so again, this is our first year of a 3 to 4 year monitoring effort. And thus far, we've detected a variety of species, including species like deer, coyotes, black bear, raccoon, otter, red squirrel, snowshoe hare, and even a short-tailed weasel. We may have even documented a wolf, which, if confirmed, again, not all these pictures are excellent quality pictures. So once we have this picture confirmed, it could be one of the first observations of a wolf on Madeline Island. Most of those species that I mentioned are not necessarily that surprising if you're, you know, familiar with the wildlife of northern Wisconsin. And, you know, the common species we're seeing on the island are, you know, like deer, coyotes, black bear, and raccoons. That's not unlike what we would see on the mainland. However, what's interesting here is that different from the mainland, we have yet to observe the full range of species that we would expect to see on the mainland. Species like bobcat, red fox, gray fox, fishers, and others, we have not yet detected them on Madeline. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that we have yet to that we won't observe them in the future as we continue our monitoring effort. But it is interesting from our perspective to notice which species aren't being detected on these islands relative to the ones that are present on the mainland. Because over time, we hope to use this data to provide a more detailed picture of the wildlife of Madeline Island and then compare the diversity and abundance of the wildlife of Madeline Island to the other islands of the archipelago as well as the mainland to better understand, again, as I mentioned, the wildlife ecology of these island systems.
Yeah, I was going to ask about comparing it to the other Apostle Islands. And I know it's still in early stages, but are there any absences or presences compared to the other Apostle Islands?
Yeah, so I should mention this effort is an expansion of an existing project that's a collaborative project between the National Park Service and the University of Wisconsin-Madison to monitor the wildlife of the broader Apostle Islands archipelago. And Madeline Island was one of the only islands where the data regarding wildlife diversity and abundance was lacking. So as we were trying to compare the species that were present and undetected from a variety of different islands of the Apostle Islands archipelago, we kept looking to Madeline Island with this big question mark and wondering what was out there. And again, preliminary, we have, you know, we're again in the first year of the study, but some interesting differences are, for example, if we compare it to Stockton Island, Madeline Island does not have the bobcat, red fox, gray fox, or fishers that we have detected on Stockton Island, which is more comparable in terms of the sense it's the second largest of the Apostle Islands, and it's more of the island is in wilderness. There are some docks on there for recreational use and some campgrounds, but it is kind of an interesting comparison to look at the species present on Stockton Island relative to Madeline Island. Part of this, the interest for one of the, I guess I should say, key drivers of this project was also to find out if American marten might be present on Madeline Island, because recently we've detected American marten in a number of the islands of the Apostle Islands. And so far, we have not yet detected on Madeline Island. Again, as I mentioned, it's a little early to say for sure. That doesn't mean that we won't detect it on the island in the, as we continue our monitoring effort. But it is interesting that we have yet to detect them on Madeline, but we have detected them on some of the other neighboring islands of the Apostles.
Stepping away from the science side of things for a moment, I've seen you've captured some great photos, a coyote staring into the camera, a bald eagle landing. Do you have any favorites that have been captured so far by these camera traps?
Yeah, so those were some of our favorites that we've shared. There's also one that one of my undergraduate students identified, and it's a great little photo of a black bear cub kind of sitting in a little pool of water that accumulated this last spring in front of a trail camera. That's a pretty neat photo as well. There's a number of other photos that you can always, going through these, looking at these pictures, it's always interesting to observe the animal behavior and trying to figure out, for example, some of these pictures, the quality of them are not as good as others, and so trying to figure out, doing the investigation of trying to figure out what that species likely is always enjoyable and a great experience for some of the undergrads that are working on this project as well.
And what's it like to be out there at Big Bay Park or over the island in general, maybe in the less seasonal parts of the year when tourists aren't maybe going up there?
Yeah, so that's one of the benefits of doing this research on Madeline Island is that Madeline Island, relative to the other islands, is easy to access. The Madeline Island ferry runs almost year-round, depending on the ice conditions. And if it's not running and there's suitable ice conditions, there's an ice road, as you mentioned. So we can get out there almost year-round to do our field work. And so we've seen the hidden beauty of Madeline Island across the seasons. It's pretty amazing during the summer when a lot of the tourists, when it's more popular to visit the island. But we've also been out there in the fall and the winter and spring and seeing those kind of hidden beauties of the island. In the fall, late fall is a great time to see the colors changing on the leaves and the blueberry leaves as well. And in the winter time is a great time to access parts of the island that are a little bit more difficult to access during the rest of the year because those places that are typically wetlands or hard to access because they're surrounded by water are often frozen during the winter, and you can navigate across that landscape a little bit more a bit easier. During the spring, sometimes it makes this relatively challenging for my students who are, you know, their major factor in running this project. I've got a dedicated group of undergraduate students that really do a great job managing this project, and the spring is always and early summer always exciting for them because they have to often bring waders with to access some of the study sites.
Eric, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yep, thanks for having me, and happy holidays to you and your listeners.
You too. That was Eric Olson, Assistant Professor of Natural Resources at Northland College. He's the project leader for Wild Madeline, which uses trail cameras to monitor wildlife on Madeline Island. First, have you ever thought about what kind of scientific things are happening when you toss a batch of cookies in the oven, or wondered what the difference is between baking soda and baking powder, and will opening the oven door really cause a cake to fall flat? On this edition of Food Friday, our guest is here to talk about the science that goes on behind the scenes when we're baking. Dr. Stuart Faramond joins us now. He's a food scientist and author of the book, The Science of Cooking, Every Question Answered to Perfect Your Cooking. Dr. Stu, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me, Rob.
Well, your book covers a lot of ground. Last time we talked to you about the science of meat. Now it's baking. And it seems to me, as somebody who cooks and bakes some, baking is like the most scientific way of cooking food. There's the most kind of finicky chemistry going on. Do I have something there?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The least forgiving way of cooking, I would say. You've got to follow the recipe most of the time. You can't just wing it.
And I have. You know, when I was in my early days of cooking, I tried to wing it, and I made some really terrible stuff trying to guess at baking.
Yeah, me too. I had some horrible bread, awful bread, yeah.
And now you spent some time in the book on different kinds of flour, even different kinds of wheat flour, making a big difference in what we cook. What, when we're going to make something, when we're baking, how do we assess what kind of flour we should be using?
Okay, so you've got to think about what is the end product that you're making. And the main question that you want to ask yourself when you're picking the flour is the amount of protein that it has in it. Because we bake things for two reasons. Well, you can kind of think of, you've got breads and you've got cakes. And you want your cakes to be light and kind of spongy and have that kind of cake feel, whereas bread needs to be chewy and have that bite to it. And the thing that makes a difference between a bread and like a sponge cake is the amount of gluten that's in it. And gluten is a protein. It's the thing that helps it to rise, and it also gives it, as I say, the chew, gives it the bite. And so if you want something that's going to be a bread, you want a high protein flour, whereas if you want something that's going to be a cake, you want a lower protein flour. And you should find on the packet what the percentage in there. If you're going for a strong flour or a bread flour, then that should have a protein of 12 to 13%, I would say at least. And if you're going for cakes, then you want something less than that, between 7 and 10 or 11%. Now, in the States, you've also got bleach flour, And bleaching is a process where they use chemicals to treat the flour after the grain's been ground up. Normally it's quite yellow when it's fresh, but we don't like yellow looking flour. So you can bleach it, which makes it turn white, but it also makes the protein weaker. And so it's excellent for making cakes. So why there are some that are high protein and some that are low protein is to do with the variety of the grain. And so they will blend together different varieties of grain just so it gets the right amount of protein in your flour. So that's the main thing that you think about is that, do I want a strong or do I want a cake flour?
And a funny thing happened when I was looking at the baking section of your book earlier today. I was reading this breakdown of the different kinds of flours, and I thought, you know, sometimes recipes tell me to sift flour. Why do I need to do that? And then I turned the page, and the caption is, why do we need to sift flour for some recipes? So answer that question. Yeah, it was perfect. Why? So what is it? I never sift it. I probably have messed things up by not sifting. What does sifting do?
Again, it depends what you're trying to make. Sometimes you can get away with not sifting it. Sometimes it's just not needed at all. Sifting, look at the recipe carefully. If it's telling you to measure out sifted flour or unsifted flour, because it makes a whole lot of difference to the volume. If you get some flour, let's just say you get 2 pounds of flour and you sift it into a bowl, you'll find that if it's sifted, it'll be about 50% bigger, 50% larger in volume. And that's because you're adding air between the individual starch grains as they're falling down. Because it's been in the packet, it gets compacted, it all settles down and all the air is lost. A bit like how if you've got, a packet of muesli or something, it all kind of compacts down if you just leave it there in the packet for ages. So it's important from a volume point of view. And also, if you're making something that you want to have kind of a fine, tender crumb, then it's important that you sift it, because if you don't sift it, when you mix it all together, you'll end up with little blobs of starch that are stuck together, and that will kind of weigh it down. So if you sift it, then when you mix it, the flour will be spread more evenly throughout the batter or throughout the dough, and so you'll get a more even crumb, and you'll get a better tasting cake at the end of the day. If it's bread, doesn't make any difference, because the whole idea of bread is to knead it and to knead all those flour particles together really hard. So you don't need to worry about sifting if you're making a bread or something really dense.
We're talking about the science of baking with Dr. Stuart Faramond. He's the author of The Science of Cooking. And looking at the science here, Dr. Stu, it seems like a lot of what's going on here is dealing with how the flour and maybe the fat and gases, whether that's the air or carbon dioxide that gets produced, how they all fit together and rise together.
Yeah, it is. As you say, it's a lot of science, and there's that interplay between you've got the protein in the flour and you've got the starches in the flour, and then you've got the sugars that you add in, and then if you've got a raising agent, you've got that as well, and so you've got the gases that are coming into it. And depending on what you're wanting, you want to get that balance right. So if it's a bread, for example, you want something, as I say, with lots of starch in it, lots of the protein. And what will happen is that when you bake it, the yeast has been producing carbon dioxide gas, and the protein forms like a network, a mesh, and that captures the little bubbles of carbon dioxide. And when you put it in the oven, those little captured bubbles, they expand as it gets bigger, as the temperature goes up and it goes up. And even as it's in the oven, during the first stage of it being in the oven, as it's warming up, you're going to kill the yeast. The yeast is a microbe that's living. But before it dies, it warms up and it gives out its last sort of spurt of life and gives a final kind of oven rise, this final boost that you get when it rises. So, and similarly, you've got the gas. If you're going to be creaming sugar and butter together, if you're going to be making a cake, then when you're doing that and you're beating it. When they used to make cakes before they came up with baking powder, They used to make sponge cakes by hand power. There's a famous cake called a pound cake, and it was so hard work that they used to get the rich people, get the slaves to do it. So they would have the hard butter, and they'd have the sugar, and they'd beat it, and they'd beat it, and they'd beat it, and they'd beat it. And as you know, when you beat it yourself, or you put it in a mixer, it makes life so much easier. It turns white, and that's because you're capturing little bubbles of air in there. And so then when you've done that, and you carefully add the flour into it afterwards, those little bubbles stay fixed inside. And then when you put it in the oven, all those air bubbles expand, and it causes the whole thing to rise. But again, if you're making something that you want to be light and fluffy, you want as little gluten of the protein as possible so that it will rise easily and have a nice sort of light texture.
Let's stay in the oven for a moment. Among the many things I've learned that I do wrong, I'll kind of get the oven close to the full temperature and figure, all right, that's close enough. I'll throw in whatever I'm baking now, and it'll get going. Bad. I really need to seriously preheat, right?
You need to. I know. It's so tempting, isn't it? You kind of get it on.
I'm being efficient.
You know, clock's ticking. You're being very energy efficient as well. But unfortunately, if we want the best outcome, we kind of have to let it preheat properly. If you're putting on to whatever, 360 degrees Fahrenheit, the thermostat will turn off when the air temperature reaches that temperature. So you've got an element in the back of your oven that's pumping out heat. The air temperature rises. It gets to 360 and it cuts off. But at that point, the whole inside of the oven is pretty cold. You could probably open it at that point and touch the wall of the oven. I don't recommend you do this, but you probably could, and it wouldn't be that hot. And so what happens when you open the oven door straight away, all that hot air just rushes out, and it's almost gone down to room temperature by the time you've managed to get your baking tray and put your stuff in there. So you're essentially putting it into a cold oven. But if you've preheated it, and that means leaving it for, depending on the power of the oven, 15 to 20 to maybe half an hour if you've got an old oven, and that will warm up the metal walls itself. So when you open the door, you've got the walls that are at 360 degrees Fahrenheit, and they're blasting heat into the middle. So as soon as you close the door again, after you've put your cake in, the temperature goes straight back up again, back up to the target temperature, rather than taking ages for that little element to pump out heat again to get the air temperature up. And when you've got it preheated as well, the walls are radiating heat inwards. So you're not just cooking from the heat of the air, you're getting heat rays, it's infrared radiation, that heat is blasting in, and that is helping to cook it on the outside as well. So preheat it, yes.
So to hammer this home, don't just let it get up to 360 or whatever and ding, and I'm ready to rock. Let it get up to 360, ding, and then wait a little while after that.
Yep, that's right. Yep. Wait 10 or 15 minutes. Ideally, if you're going to do, if we think about energy, if you're going to, say, make a roast, you do your roast, and then you just get your roast out or whatever it is you've been doing in there, meat or whatever, and then you can just leave it on, and it's already up to temperature, and you can then put in whatever it is you're baking. But if you want the best results, preheat it.
We're talking about the science of baking with Dr. Stuart Fairmond. He's a food scientist and the author of The Science of Cooking, Every Question Answered to Perfect Your Cooking. We are talking about baking, and you can join in on Food Friday at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the science of baking? Do you wonder what's going on in there in your favorite bread, cake, cookies, whatever you're making? And what are you baking this time of year for the holidays? Could you use some pointers for that last minute, say, Christmas baking project? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our Food Friday conversation with Dr. Stuart Fairmond, a.k.a. Dr. Stu. He is a food scientist. He's the author of the book, The Science of Cooking. You can join in with your baking-related questions and baking science questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Have you ever wondered what is going on with your food when you bake it? Do you have a baking or culinary question for our food scientist today? Is there a baking project that always goes wrong for you? He might have a solution. Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll go to our callers. Darlene is on the line in Eau Claire. Darlene, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about, Darlene?
Well, I can't use regular baking powder because baking powder has cornstarch in it that makes it thinner. And so I looked up in one of my cookbooks and it said that I can make my own. So I use cream of tartar and I use baking soda to make baking powder. I want to know, why can't I just use baking soda?
Ah, and you tackle this in the book, Dr. Stu, the difference between baking soda and baking powder.
Yes, yes. Hi, Darlene. I've had that problem where you go to the cupboard and you think the recipe says baking powder and I've only got baking soda. They kind of sound the same, kind of put them in. But no, as you've discovered, they're not the same thing. Baking powder is a mixture of an acid and an alkali. So it's bicarbonate of soda, which is an alkali. And there's an acid that's added in there as well. And if you remember maybe from your school days, when an acid and an alkali come together, they react. And the acid and the alkali that's in baking powder produce gas. They produce carbon dioxide. The baking soda is just an alkali on its own. It's bicarbonate of soda. It's just an alkali. So you put that in. If there isn't an acid in there, it won't react. It won't produce any gas. So you need to add something acidic for the baking soda to work. So you found that cream of tartar works. Buttermilk can also work. Anything that's acidic, if you're adding, you know, you can put lemon juice in, for example, will have the same effect. Darlene, what kind of proportions do you use when you make your own baking powder?
I just mix cream of tartar and baking soda, and I put them together, and I press seal them really tight.
And about, do you use about even amounts, Darlene, or a little more?
No, I use 3 to 1. I use 3 cream of tartar to 1 of baking soda, whatever measurement I use.
Yeah, that's about right. That's about right. That's about the right ratio. The other advantage, if you don't have a problem with baking powder itself, is that they sometimes put in 2 types of acids. One acid reacts very quickly, and the other is like a slow release acid, so it will rise twice when it's in the oven if you're using using a baking powder. The thing to bear in mind is that those acids, the acid and the alkali, they're powders, and they only react when water is added. So as soon as you've got your mix and you've added your baking soda and your cream of tartar or your baking powder, whichever you're using, that reaction will start. So if you're doing it, don't just leave it on the side without putting it in the oven. As soon as you put your baking powder or your baking soda and cream of tartar in, you want to put it into the oven straight away.
Darlene, hope that helps. Thanks for calling. We'll go next to Michael with us in Butternut. Michael, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to ask about?
I was wondering about baking with cast iron pans and like Dutch ovens. I've done some cornbread that usually I've always been told to have good cornbread. Got to use cast iron. And I guess how it goes with other types of baking, and you know, should you preheat the cast iron, or certain things don't work good in cast just because you can't preheat it and then put it in the pan?
Michael, thanks. Does it make a difference, Dr. Stu?
That's a really good question. Cast iron is a fabulous material for cooking with generally. And so if you've got cast iron, that's brilliant. The reason why it's good is that it spreads heat out really evenly. So if you've got a cast iron skillet, for example, you don't get hot spots. If it's a nice thick skillet, the heat comes up from the burner and spreads out evenly across it. Whereas if you had a thin kind of aluminium, say, a frying pan that you put on the hob, you're going to get hot spots where the flame is closest to the underside of the pan. And in the same way, when you're putting your bread in, if you're using cast iron, you're spreading the heat over nice and evenly, and it will retain that temperature really, really well. So cast iron, brilliant for keeping hot. So if you do have to take something out or put it back in again, it will retain its temperature really well. But as you probably discovered with cast iron, the problem is that it takes a long time to heat up. So retains heat very well, spreads out very well, but it takes a long time to heat up. And while that's good for bread, there may be some things that it doesn't work quite so well with. So if you're putting something in from cold, so I'm guessing that you always preheat your cast iron before you put the bread on, is that right?
Yep, and then usually it would be something that I could, like, slide in easily.
Oop, we're losing you there, Michael. But it sounds like he does preheat that cast iron skillet.
Yeah, yeah. So, and that absolutely, you can't really cook with cast iron in an oven unless you're going to preheat it because it will take so long to warm up. So if you're with breads, I'd say it's okay. You might run into problems. So if, say, you're doing cookies, for example, they won't be quite as brown if you're doing it with cast iron because it'll take longer to get up the temperature. And so the underside won't get as hot and so it won't be as brown. So things like that, you won't, it's not as good for. So generally you want something that is dark in color. I check out reviews because you can get cheap ones that kind of warp and bend really easily. But something dark in color will serve most purposes really well.
Michael, thanks for that call. We're talking to Dr. Stu Faramond, author of The Science of Cooking. We're looking at the science of baking on this Food Friday. Back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Cedarburg. Jim, hi.
Hello. Happy holidays to you all.
To you too. What did you want to bring up, Jim?
When I use a box mix to bake a cake, I always end up with a crown, much higher in the middle. I was wondering if there's any kind of adjustments to be made so that I end up with a flat cake that I don't have to cut the top off of.
Oh, yeah, that makes it a lot easier to make a layer cake if that you don't have that arch in the middle. Dr. Stu, any thoughts?
Yeah, they make packet mixes deliberately so that they rise really easily. They add extra additives to it. They add things called emulsifiers, which help give the baking powders an extra boost. They make them in the way that they do, so they're pretty idiot-proof, so that anybody can do it and it will rise, whatever. The problem is, as you've discovered, is that they can get a bit overexcitable and get a bit too big. So the way that I would recommend is to do your own, unfortunately. What kind of cake pan do you use?
What kind of tray do you use?
Yeah.
Just a regular aluminum or a stainless steel.
Okay. I'm just trying to wonder whether changing that to maybe a different one might help. Because if it's a very, say it's a thin, fairly cheap kind of metal, then the outsides will cook very quickly, and so they'll solidify quickly, and so you'll set around the edge and the middle will rise. So I would consider using, say, a thicker material, or you could try ceramic or something like that, so that it gives the outside a bit more time to rise so that it's more even with the top.
Jim,
they're my recommendations. Hope that helps.
Jim, good luck. Thanks for that call. Dr. Stu, we just have a few seconds left. We haven't even gotten into fats yet. One lesson I took away is don't use soft, low-fat margarine. Briefly, why?
No. It's loads of water in it. Loads of water in it. If you look at, like, when you've got the low-fat stuff, the reason it's low-fat is because it's got water in it. It's sometimes up to 90% can be water. They've blended it and whisked it together with emulsifiers and all sorts of stuff to make it solid. But you don't want all that water in your cake or whatever it is you're going to make, because it will end up damp and it won't rise and it'll be a mess. So don't ever use a low-fat spread.
Dr. Stu, as always, it's a lot of fun. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Dr. Stuart Faramond. He's a food scientist and the author of the book, The Science of Cooking, Every Question Answered to Perfect Your Cooking. We've been talking about the science of baking. Well, I bet you're going to be doing a lot of baking, maybe this holiday weekend, and we want, you're not going to send us samples. I've accepted that. It's taken me years. But you can send us pictures. You can email an attachment to ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Send us that cake, the Christmas cookies, whatever you got. We'll give them a look and tell us if they were good or not, or if you had some baking science troubles. little Food Friday follow-up. We were talking earlier today around the office about some of the best recipes we've ever found on the internet. I thought that might make actually a good segment for the show sometime. I have some favorites, and executive producer Judith Sears Poisson has some favorites, I'm sure. Judith, hi.
I do. And, you know, I have a huge bookcase full of gorgeous cookbooks.
Uh-huh. And you use them.
And I use them, but I really do go to the internet a lot. And, you know, I was, when you asked me about that, I thought, oh, yeah, there's some great ones. So I have a green lentil and wild rice mix that also has carrots and celery and onions. They call for pancetta. I actually use like a smoked turkey kielbasa, chop it up. Really good, really savory. Also Asian turkey meatballs with bok choy, and you kind of, you brown the meatballs, but then you steam it all with soy sauce and stuff like that. Super good.
And do you have a like a method for finding a good online recipe?
No, I stumble across them, or, you know, I use Epicurious a lot. I use Cooking Light actually has some really good ones. I'll just plug in an ingredient and see what comes up. But I also, you know, I'll see like things that come in different newsletters I get, and I'll send it to myself as an email. So sometimes I just actually search in my own email and things just pop up magically.
Yeah, and I've done searches and I often end up, the ones I like are just, you know, individual person or
right.
food blogger, and they'll say, this is the one that's been a big hit, the biggest
yep.
hit. I stumbled across it myself.
Yep.
And we've got some great ones. So maybe, yeah, we'll get some from listeners.
That'd
and
be great.
Make a nice
we'll
online list. Definitely. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.